And besides, it is a universally received opinion that it is not sensible to bring up a boy in the lap of his parents. Natural affection makes parents too soft, too indulgent, even the wisest of them. They are incapable of either punishing his faults or of bringing him up as roughly and as dangerously as he ought to be.
Hello, my name is Ryan Hamill, and this is New Humanists, the podcast of the Ancient Language Institute. I'm joined by Jonathan Roberts, my co-host and co-founder of the Ancient Language Institute. We're on a quest to discover what a renewed humanism looks like for the modern world. Well, welcome back to New Humanists. Welcome back to Michel de Montaigne, part two. This episode is all about why Jonathan is shipping his children away and not raising them himself, as you heard.
It's too difficult. Got to outsource it.
That's right. They won't. Your kids won't know difficulty if you raise them.
Yeah, exactly. So I actually don't fully agree with this quote, but I'm glad we're starting with it because it kind of answers a question that I've had in my mind while reading the Old Testament. So there's the story of... So we have, it's both Samuel, happens to Samuel, and...
And Eli.
Eli, right. First with Eli.
I knew exactly where you were going with this. First with
Eli, it's like you have this wise man who's godly, 100% dedicated to the service of Israel and to the service of God, and his children are the worst. Terrible. And it was just growing up hearing that story, it was just so puzzling. It's like, this doesn't make any sense. What's going on with the character development in the Old Testament? You know, it's like, what's happening here? And then, but then it's kind of understandable with Eli, right? Because it's like, okay, well, who knows what's going on there? But look, Samuel is seeing this. Samuel sees that Eli has these two reprobate children. But then the exact same thing happens with Samuel, and that's just unacceptable. You can, no, it's like, you saw this happen. It was in front of you. Why did it happen to you too? And I think that this quote that I read in the open is a partial answer to that.
And interestingly, just to add a layer onto that, which I think is implied in what you're saying, but it's worth spelling out, it's not like Eli doesn't know how to raise a kid to be godly. He does it with Samuel. Samuel is dedicated to the temple and raised by Eli and raised into a great and holy prophet, but he can't raise his own sons correctly.
Yeah. Natural affection. Natural affection. Disorder.
Storge is, blown out here.
Yeah. So it's a, I really don't think that the answer is outsourcing your parenthood, but it's taming this natural affection and properly channeling it. But it does seem like there is some wisdom to having your kids kind of experience the mentorship and authority of people other than yourself, just so that you can have some distance in terms, you get to observe that. It's like, oh man, does my kid really behave that way? It kind of becomes real when you go to somebody else's house and your kid starts doing crazy stuff. That's good. It's good. It's a good reality check. And yeah, you should not let your natural affection turn into self-indulgence, but think about the end. It's like, what sort of a kid do I want to raise? What should he become? And is this the path to that? No, maybe not. Maybe I shouldn't let him throw fits. You know, I shouldn't let him become a little bandit.
Right. Yeah. So this essay of Montaigne's that we're going to be looking at, it follows immediately on the last one we did, which was on pedantry or on schoolmaster's learning, and which was a big contrast between, I would say, being a lover of opinion versus making that learning, those opinions you've come across, into your own wisdom, especially from the point of view of a learned person or a teacher. And so apparently, judging from the commentary that comes along in this edition, people would come over to Montaigne's house and read that essay and talk about it with him, and then I suppose maybe this Madame Diane de Foix, Countess of Gourson, read it and said, I want a fuller treatment of how to educate a child. You've written all this about teachers and kind of making fun of them. But how? What's the positive case? How do you do something properly? And that's what this essay on educating children is all about. And you get a lot of biographical information, including further fleshing out of what we talked about in past episodes, both the Multania episode and the more recent one with Latin God Emperor Timothy Griffith, who raised his kids similarly to how Montaigne was raised. And so we get some more filling out of that picture, which is really interesting. And I think the portrait he draws of his father, a very loving portrait, goes some way to explaining why he has this opinion. His father just sounds like super chill, very loving and tender, very concerned with his kid's upbringing. And so it's very good, it sounds like, that Montaigne got this very Teutonic tutor to only speak Latin to him and bring him up a little more harshly, because it doesn't sound like the dad had any capacity to be harsh based on Montaigne's depiction.
Yeah, and it's so funny when he's describing that episode. He talks about how Latin kind of spilled over to the broader household.
That's really interesting. And also
to nearby villages where they started calling certain tools by their Latin names.
Yeah, really, really interesting. That's towards the end. We'll get to that. But the real essence of this essay, I think, is similar to the previous one that we read. It's this preference for practical wisdom that's been assimilated into the mind of the student over and against bookish, word-centric education. And so those aren't opposites, but there is a distinction that for Montaigne is very important. And so we'll kind of draw that out. He has a few fun quips against the French here, because, you know, he's situating his polemics in his context and where he's at. He doesn't really like what he sees. Not like on the first page. He says, in introducing this essay, because this is kind of almost an epistle. It's dedicated to this Countess of Gourson who apparently asked him. And so he has to, in a true Renaissance way, praise her and denigrate himself. So yeah, these ravings, that's what he calls his essays. They're very French, a little bit about everything and nothing about anything. And so I just thought that was kind of funny.
One thing that's interesting is we get, I think, his two favorite authors from antiquity. What do you think? Plutarch?
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Definitely Plutarch.
Seneca.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Which, you know, you just see it. You just see it, especially here, right? I'm writing a letter to my nephew. Are you?
Right. This is just some friendly advice, nephew. This isn't a philosophical treatise at all. I'm just telling you my experience.
It seems to fit very well with his understanding of how virtue can be acquired. This is also later in the essay, but he has this vision for how acquiring virtue can be something delightful and pleasant and joyful, as opposed to some drudge, dreadful, heavy burden. If you think about this essay format versus a more rigorous philosophical treatise, one is more delightful and pleasing to read than the other.
Then, at least as our translator has rendered it, the philosopher's chop logic, which he's not interested in. One other interesting, helpful thing that our editor has pointed out for us, it's a little distracting, I'll be honest, in this Penguin Classics edition, all these textual critical notes saying, like, here's, you know, version A of the essay, and then version B and version C. I mean, they're certainly, I'm sure, helpful for a real scholar of Montaigne. Generally not that helpful. But in the case of this essay, you really see how sometime in between version A of the essay and version C of the essay, he read a lot of Plato. And all of this Platonic and Socratic stuff comes in version C of the essay. And so one of those is, I don't know if I have it at hand, but oh yeah, so something like references to Plato's doctrine of education and the Republic, the true meaning of philosophy being the growth of the virtues. He's citing Plato to this effect. But towards the beginning, he has, when he's kind of making fun of himself, he has this Socratic boast. And so he's like, I'm so weak, paltry, lumbering, and dull compared with these other men who are more learned than I am, the ancients in particular. At least my opinions frequently coincide with theirs. I can congratulate myself on that. One other advantage I have over normal people, I know, and many do not, the vast difference there is between them and me. So most people aren't aware of the gulf separating them from the wisdom of the ancients. I, Montaigne, am aware how great a distance it is. So I'm aware of my own ignorance. It's this kind of Socratic, the only way I'm wiser than anybody, if I am in fact, is that I know that I don't know, that kind of thing. And so this is how it kind of starts, is I don't know a lot. I know the ancients are very wise and that I'm not very wise. And I wonder if we should keep that in the back of our mind reading through this essay, especially when towards the end he returns to kind of denigrating his own education, which is a very funny thing to do in this long essay laying out the ideal education. You'd think that if you want to write a convincing essay on education, you'd say, well, here's the way I've been educated and I've learned a lot and here's how it's been so useful for me, instead of bookending it with, yeah, I really don't know very much. And what I did learn, I've forgotten. So it's not very encouraging. And it's the same ambivalent style we saw in the previous essay where Montaigne says, well, education is certainly helpful for virtue, right? Look at these historical figures. Well, maybe not. Look at all these horrible people who learning doesn't seem to have helped. And in fact, learning seems to have made a lot of people worse. So maybe learning doesn't make you a better person. And it was a very ambivalent essay. And this one is similar.
One thing that, yeah, along with that, it seems like he has this reaction towards the thinking of his time where education is very kind of child-centric. It's the children, when they're young especially, that need to be educated. Because if you don't get them, you know, before they're six, they're ruined. That's when education happens. I'm making up the age range, but he definitely has this sense of like, look, the kids, they're just going to forget a bunch of stuff. They're just going to forget a bunch of stuff. So what do you want to leave them with? And maybe you want to continue education. He doesn't really say that but explicitly, but it seems like he wants to move away from, you know, you're just educating kids, or education ends with childhood sort of mentality.
I'm not sure if I draw the distinction that way in the sense of being child-centric so much as facts. It seems like the received wisdom at the time that he's writing is that you have to cram as many facts as possible into the heads of kids. And so he's trying to say, and I think this is related to your point. I mean, he's saying like, first of all, yeah, you forget the facts. What was the point of learning the facts in the first point? Second of all, the facts don't really help with anything, even if you remembered them. You know, what's the point of knowing all the constellations? Do you think the constellations determine your fate? Like, why do you need to know them? And so here's a kind of illustrative passage. He says, teachers are forever bawling into our ears as though pouring knowledge down through a funnel. Our task is merely to repeat what we have been told. This is the state of things. It's just like, the teacher's job is just dump as much information into their students' heads. Montaigne's alternative is this. I would want our tutor to put that right. As soon as the mind in his charge allows it, he should make it show its fettle by appreciating and selecting things and by distinguishing between them. The tutor should sometimes prepare the way for the boy, sometimes let him do it all on his own. I do not want the tutor to be the only one to choose topics or to do all the talking. When the boy's turn comes, let the tutor listen to his pupil talking. And then he quotes, I was quoting Socrates, but The source is, it's not clear. It says, for those who want to learn, the obstacle can often be the authority of those who teach. So there's this kind of active quality to education, active on the part of the student, that the student needs to be assimilating into himself the significance of all these words. And so, yeah, if he's merely able to recite and memorize the facts or the words, it doesn't really matter all that much. He says, I'd rather the student reproduce the idea in his own words and forget the source, because you want him to make the wisdom of Cicero or whoever part of his mental furniture, part of his habit of thinking.
Yeah, and that's an idea that you see in the essay that we read last time. I think that this is in what you were reading, the teachers are forever bawling into our ears, that section. Just before that, he lays out what he wants to see, which I think is worth noting. He says,
yeah, we should spend some time on that, because this is, I think, really central.
Yeah, he says, since I would prefer that he turn out to be an able man, not an erudite one, I would wish you to be careful to select as guide for him a tutor with a well-formed rather than a well-filled brain. But this next part I think is important too. Let both be looked for, but place character and intelligence before knowledge, and let him carry out his responsibilities in a new way. So I think this is one of, we talked about this a little bit last time, where on first read, you can kind of get the sense like, oh, he's just kind of anti-learning. But it's more about ordering priorities. So character formation, ability, he sees these as more important. Like, he needs to be able to do stuff. He needs to be able to do stuff well. And then let's talk about knowledge, because we also talked about how knowledge can be a tool for wickedness. So it's like, prepare him to use the tool first, and then give him the tool.
So here's something I was thinking about after reading this page that you read that from, and especially that paragraph and the beginning of it when I was driving. Maybe this can be an essay of my own, an essay. But just thinking about the proper end of education, which, like, yeah, I mean, if you're still listening to this podcast, however many 60-something episodes in we are, that's kind of all we talk about. So I was going to say, I hope you're not bored of it. But if you're still listening, clearly you're not. And just thinking about the various justifications from a pretty high level for learning. And so just thinking about our world, 21st century America, I would say the first one, and this is first from my perspective, having gone to public school and then gone to a private secular liberal arts college, you're going to change the world. You're a world changer. That's the point of education. My college had one of the big majors that attracts a lot of students.
Are you about to do the graph meme?
Oh, the bell curve thing? Kind of the IQ bell curve meme. But one of the big majors at my college was DWA, Diplomacy and World Affairs. And so people want to be diplomats and work for NGOs and work in politics. And this is, I would say, the kind of elite liberal assumption about education. And then against that, I think one thing that's we've talked about that's common among conservatives is, oh, we don't need another Starbucks barista with a philosophy degree. It's like, take your gender theory degree and shove it. Learn a trade, you know, something useful. Who needs to read Shakespeare again? And so that would be like money. Education is job training. And then I think in the classical education movement, very refreshing alternative to go to school to get money. You have something a little more elevated. It's about the ordering of the affections. It's becoming a virtuous person, appreciating learning for its own sake, a more detached one. So here, these are three kind of modern accounts seem to be the three on offer generally. And there's other people with their other. So yeah, so there's DWA, be a world changer. There's, we need more plumbers. the money one. And then there's the, like Newman, just knowledge for its own sake. Those seem to be three main. But in this paragraph, we get some alternatives. Helpful. It's helpful to read old books because they don't think all the same thoughts as you. Here's the main two camps Montaigne presents. Listen. Learning, my lady, is a great ornament and a useful instrument of wondrous service, especially in those who are fortunate to live in so high an estate as yours. Okay, that's just the introduction. Yeah, it's nice to be an aristocrat because then you get to spend a lot of time studying. Cool. And in truth, she, learning, does not find her true employment in hands base and vile. We might not say that today, but whether that's true or not, you can decide. She, learning, is far more proud to deploy her resources for the conducting of a war, the commanding of a nation, and the winning of the affection of a prince or of a foreign people, than for drawing up dialectical arguments, pleading in a court of appeal, or prescribing a mass of pills. Great. Some things never change.
Yeah, so I just have this image of, like, you know, Montaigne, classical school, to wage war, to govern the nation, winning the favor of princes.
Exactly.
Those are the things that you'll get.
So yeah, here we have diplomacy, war, politics, government. Say it's government because you're governing. DWG instead of DWA. Not quite what my college views it, but very similar. Versus logic, law, and medicine, which is actually not so different from go make some money. I mean, this is what Gian Battista Vico around the same time was complaining about. It's like, oh, people just send their kids to school so they can become a lawyer, right, or a doctor and earn a bunch of money.
Prescribe a bunch of pills. Here we go, big pharma.
And so he's saying, look, conducting a war, governing the state, and doing diplomacy is really the best, is what learning most wants to be deployed for. And it's much better and useful for that. And those things are better and more useful than logic, law, or medicine. And then he has the kind of the middle position, which is a bit down in the next paragraph. The son of the house. So this is the noble woman who's being written to. She has a son, or I think she's pregnant, and Montaigne is assuming she'll have a son. The son of the house is seeking book learning, not to make money. So there's them, go make money, go become a doctor. Not to make money, nor for external advantages, but rather for those which are truly his own, those which inwardly enrich and adorn him. So this seems to be the kind of Newman knowledge, wisdom for its own sake. It's book learning is just good and you should kind of do it. So we kind of reproduce here on this page the three positions we see nowadays, but with a little more insight and a little more texture to them. And it seems like Montaigne wants to combine this knowledge and wisdom for its own sake with the political arts construed broadly. And you're going to have this book learning that will be an adornment to your soul, but really it all needs to be oriented around making you useful and virtuous and powerful. Is that a fair kind of summary of what's going on here?
Yeah, I think that definitely sounds fair. I mean, you have we know that Seneca is one of his favorites, and so his approach to, well, almost everything is going to be very, very practical, but practical as tailored by a particular vision of what virtue is and what humans and human life is for. And to me, it's so interesting. You know, the first thing that he mentions, conducting of a war. It came up last time, and it seems like this was one of the things that, you know, in casual conversation with the very learned, seems like he would have. I don't know if he writes on war somewhere. This might come out, but I don't know exactly how he would. What sorts of questions he would ask. Like, would he set up like a war scenario? It's like, what would be your tactic here? But it seemed like this was a way in which he would like measure someone's competence. It's like, are you able to think through this scenario? Are you able to make practical decisions that affect the lives of hundreds, if not thousands, of soldiers. Like, can you do that? That's a great thing to do. That's a noble thing to be able to do, because you have lives, you know, in your hands and the well-being of your nation. So anyway, his interest in war is something that is pretty unique in terms of the things that we've read in for this podcast, which is why it's especially interesting to me. Like, nobody's really talking about waging war.
Yeah. One thing that on this note that has occurred to me reading ancient history is how important it is for military leaders, and you see this over and over in Greece and Rome, to have a way with words, because the way in which their soldiers fight, whether their soldiers will even fight, can come down to charisma. Whether you have a mutiny or not depends on if your soldiers believe in what they're doing and in what you're asking them to do. But that has to be married to judgment. And so, like, one great example that occurs to me where you have one but not the other is in Herodotus, Dionysius of Phocaea, during the Ionian Revolt. The Greeks are deciding, like, are we going to fight the Persians? And Dionysius gives this awesome speech. Things are on the edge of a knife. That's how it opens, or something like that. And it's really compelling. He's like, follow me and I'll show you how to beat the Persians. And the Greeks are like, yeah, let's do it. He's got the words. And then he proceeds to drill them. And the kind of lazy Ionians are not ready for stricter non-Ionian Greek practice. He proceeds to drill them hard for 7 straight days. And eventually the Ionians are like, this stinks. We'd rather be slaves than work with this guy.
Yeah.
And so they desert and they get absolutely crushed. Ionian revolt does not go well. So kind of lacked a certain judgment, but had the words. But you really need both. And that's why conducting war is not just a matter of like chess pieces in the sense of mere tactics or even strategy. It has these soft skills that are evident from reading history.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite episodes in book 6. And to add to his qualities, you know, he knows what needs to be done. He also knows how to do it, right? Because he's training them well, but they're just being pushed too much for their own likes. They cannot properly appreciate the end of, you know, being free from the Persians. And what's the line where they say, we signed up for this? We'd rather be slaves, right? Yeah. It's just such a wonderful episode that gives you exactly what you're discussing. You need to be able to teach, basically, right?
Exactly.
You're a teacher and you're trying to teach them, no, this is good. You like this. You like this because you want to be free from the mead. But you also need to, if you're a good teacher, you also need to take into account the frame of your students. And you need to be aware, it's like, well, the Ionians, if these were Spartans, I could really push. But these Ionians, I think I'm going to have to start a little, just start a little slower, rub some shoulders with them, tell a couple jokes, like just hang out, you know, just gain some more robust loyalty before going crazy with the training.
Yeah. Yeah. In this essay, Montaigne says, it is harder to descend than ascend. And he's talking about the teacher. The teacher has to go meet the student where he's at and lead him on. But that's actually a really hard task, to know where's that golden mean where you're still pushing the student and leading him where he needs to go, but you're not discouraging him or being incomprehensible. That's just a generally wise reflection on teaching. You see it with language teaching for sure. Is you can't just let the students relax because they're just going to stall. You have to push them, but you can't push them too far or they get discouraged.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I've heard a lot of really, really competent folks in the languages, you know their Greek very well, know their Latin very well, say, I don't know how to teach beginners. And that's because, you know, you need to descend.
It's harder to descend.
You need to
descend.
You need to understand the frame of the student, and in a different context, a colleague of ours called it the tragedy of the beginner.
Yeah,
because beginners have less resources to work with. Like they have nothing.
Yep,
they have nothing, and so you need to give them a lot. They need a lot to be given to them in order for them to be successful.
Exactly. Well, if we want to spend more time on Montaigne and his thoughts on war, perhaps in the future we can do essay 34 of book 2, Observations on Julius Caesar's Methods of Waging War. Perhaps we'll get a fuller treatment of what it means to wage a war, and maybe even some education.
I'm going to lobby for it.
One thing that reminded me of reading C.S. Lewis, obligatory things reference.
Yeah.
In this essay.
I feel like he's dropped a little. I feel like we've grown slack in our love for Lewis.
Well,
it's coming back
right here. One of the most delightful things about reading Lewis is his talent for analogy and illustrations of relatively complex arguments and ideas. And so we have a great one here from Montaigne about this whole idea of the student has to assimilate the knowledge into himself to, make it his own and make it useful, rather than just being head knowledge, just bookish learning, just mere erudition. And this is also an illustration of the revisions he made to the essay after reading more Plato. I'll just read it. If he, the student, wants to, let him not be afraid to forget where he got them. These are ideas, where he got them from, but let him be sure that he knows how to appropriate them. Truth and reason are common to all. They no more belong to the man who first put them into words than to him who last did so. It is no more secundum Platonem, according to Plato, than secundum me, according to me. Plato and I see and understand it the same way. And then here's the Louisian analogy. Bees ransack flowers here and flowers there. Then they make their own honey, which is entirely theirs, and no longer thyme or marjoram. Similarly, the boy will transform his borrowings. He will confound their forms so that the end product is entirely his, namely his judgment, the forming of which is the only aim of his toil, his study, and his education. Forming of your own judgment. That's the whole point of all of this. And so, all this bookish learning, it's this kind of nice adornment. It's very pleasurable. But if it doesn't cash out in being able to conduct warfare effectively, it was pointless. You need that judgment.
Well, speaking of analogies, the one that caught my eye is a little bit more, I'll let the listener judge. So this is what he says. Spewing up food exactly as you have swallowed it, it's evidence of a failure to digest and assimilate it. The stomach has not done its job if during concoction it fails to change the substance and the form of what it is given. So when you're explaining one of Plato's arguments, if it sounds exactly like Plato, maybe have you understood it? Has it become yours? Or can you say it in your own way? It also makes me think about math. Where we are kind of obsessed with like the right answer, like what's the right answer? What's the right answer? And Montaigne seems to be more of the mind of, well, can you show me the steps? Has your soul been formed in such a way that you can figure out the steps? And then once you're able to do that, then the answer is yours, is your answer.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone else is just cheating on the test.
Yep. Yep, exactly. And speaking of steps, he talks about these famous dancing masters. And in this passage, it to me recalls what we read with Tim from Ad Herennium. You remember the three parts of learning from Ad Herennium? Theory, imitation, practice. And so he's like take Pavel and Pompeo. These apparently famous dancing teachers from his time. Imagine if we just learned dancing by just sitting there and watching them. Like, that would be ridiculous. You can't learn to dance just by watching someone dance. You have to practice it. You have to stand up and do the steps yourself. Yeah, you have to watch them. But you also have to be told what, like, about the steps, what you're supposed to be doing, so that then when you watch them, you're looking at the correct things. And then you have to stand up and do it yourself to practice it. Otherwise, these teachers who don't take those three steps, he has a great phrase here, they are seeking to give instruction to our understanding without making it dance. The whole process of learning, of teaching and learning, is this: you have to make the knowledge, you have to make the facts, you have to make the book dance for your student, or else it's not alive. It's like, imagine trying to learn how to manage a horse or a pike or a lute or to sing without any practice, as these fellows do, who want to teach us to judge well and to speak well, but who never give us exercises in judging or speaking. So as a teacher, yeah, get your students to practice making good judgments. Otherwise, you can't. They won't learn judgment. They won't learn how to conduct a war.
That would be bad.
Very bad. That's the whole point of education.
There you go. You know, this phrase, like forming exercises and forming judgment, reminds me of that. Wow, was that a year ago? That was a year ago. We went to this conference in Phoenix, and the Christopher Schleck the Great, who I'm sure doesn't even know of the existence of this humble emporium of podcasting. he had this great workshop session on basically, should we be doing like these research essays in high school? Like, is this how we should do rhetoric? And he proposed a different model, which is, you know, you have this problem, like, who gets the inheritance? You know, this kid, or, you know, he comes up with these kind of legal sounding scenarios, and then students are supposed to make a judgment and make a speech on them. And there you see a nice kind of wedding between rhetoric and judgment, because you're supposed to be able to, you know, make a judgment and present it in a compelling way. And I wonder if this is the sort of thing that Montaigne has in mind. If not, it's still a great exercise to achieve those ends. So get rid of the research essay, the lendum est.
Yeah, seriously. Well, on the one would expect, if one of the most important roles of education is political art, which includes the art of waging war, one would expect that the student needs to learn physical toughness as well. And sure enough, Montaigne addresses that. And in so doing, has some interesting reflections on the relationship between the mind and the body. And he says, yeah, I mean, here's my kind of takeaway from it, and then why don't you correct and expand it? It seems to be that in order to endure physical suffering, you need a tough mind. But you can't get a tough mind without experiencing physical suffering. It's like your mind learns to be tough through the medium of the body. And so you have to, as Paul says, beat my body and make it my slave. And then your mind becomes tough. And Montaigne, again, very self-effacing. Oh, I get pinched and I react more than some people who get beaten. I'm such a weakling, which is kind of hard to believe. He was a soldier and whatever, but yeah, that's me. What's your take on this passage?
Yeah, well, yeah. So he says exactly that, right? You can form the mind through the exercise of the body, which is really, really interesting. And you can kind of see how that would work, right? You're building endurance. Your mind is becoming tougher. Like, your willpower is increasing. Your ability to endure certain difficulties can grow. But he also talks about how you can't really form the body by forming the mind, right? Like, there's no amount of reading of Socratic dialogues is going to make you strong. You might be able to have a certain kind of endurance, but it's not going to be a physical sort of endurance the way that Montaigne is describing here. And so one of the things that he ends up saying is that if you're going to train up a whole person, you should prefer one over the other, because by doing that one, you actually get both. By training up the body, you're also training the mind.
Yes, yes. And so the body is more powerful than the mind is, because you can train the mind by training the mind, but you can also train the mind by training the body, but it doesn't work the other way. You can't train the body by training the mind. And this is similar to things you see in like Plato, where like in Phaedrus, where rational intelligence doesn't have strength on its own to reign in desire. The mind needs the thumos, the spiritedness, in order to reign in desire. And so, yeah, the mind is kind of this ornament. It can be useful in pointing the way, but it can't effectuate anything on its own.
Yeah, that's a great passage. And it's interesting. I think it's also near the passage where he talks about eating, where it's like, you do not want picky eaters. You should be able to eat anything.
Like me. I can eat and drink anything except beer, he says. I never got used to beer. Do not like beer.
Yeah, he does say except. Does he say that he doesn't like it?
I thought so. I'm trying to look for that passage.
Because he does say except beer. And part of me wonders whether, you know, he read about Julius Caesar and he's like, oh, Caesar doesn't drink beer.
Oh, maybe that it's prescriptive, not normative.
He's not a proto-Baptist. He's just a partisan of Caesar in this way.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. Who knows? I don't think he explains. I think he just says except beer.
We get some great endorsements of Plutarch and of Livy. You'd mentioned Plutarch earlier, but he calls, what does he call Plutarch? Our favorite. He says, the study of history can be quite useless by memorizing dates. Here, I'm sure Montaigne would not appreciate Dorothy Sayers' thoughts about the teaching of history. But you can imagine what he wants. He wants the lessons of history to be encoded into the souls of the student. And he says Livy is particularly good for this. And this makes me want to get back to our Livy series, which we haven't done in a long time. He says, for some, Livy is purely a grammatical study. For others, he is philosophically dissected, penetrating into the most abstruse parts of our nature. He said, yes, I really believe this. There's a way to skate over Livy, and just, it's like one thing after another. But there's a way to read him very slowly and see how profound it is.
Yeah, and he, one of the things that Montaigne says in that section is that Livy actually doesn't give you everything. He just gives you like these tantalizing tidbits that make you want more instead of just giving you a full treatment of something. One of the things that is interesting, so he is in the tradition of Quintilian and Erasmus, that he's anti-beatings, no beatings in school. And it's interesting to think about that in connection to his desire to raise up tough, strong characters. Because I imagine that some people would think, oh, well, just beat them. They'll become tough. But he takes the same lesson as some of the figures that we've read, that really, if you do that, you're only teaching them to hate learning and to fear. You're just teaching them how fear works and that they're afraid. They're afraid of the big person with the big stick. That does not lead to courage, and that also does not pave this way that he wants for virtue being something joyful and pleasant to acquire.
Yeah, yeah, I think he would. He has something of that Gothic skepticism towards book learning that we saw in that article we read with Colin Gorrie, where, yeah, you beat kids in school and you make them timorous. It'd be better for them to just ride their horses in the cold. As Montaigne says, ignoring medical advice. Well, there's a lot more here. We can't go on forever. We talked about, yeah, philosophy bringing joy, which I think is important here. And, you know, he doesn't really talk about Christianity almost at all. in this essay, but I do think that bit about the joy of philosophy does sound a lot like the gospel. I'll just read a little passage that I enjoyed. The tutor will then be teaching him, the student, a new lesson. What makes true virtue highly valued is the ease, usefulness, and pleasure we find in being virtuous. That's kind of paradoxical and surprising. I think it actually lines up with what Aristotle says in Nicomachean Ethics, that, you know, if it's hard for you to abstain from smoking, like, okay, that's not really a virtue, that you have like continence, it's this kind of painful self-control. But when it's like easy to not, you don't even think about it. It's like, well, I'm not going to smoke. Like, then it's become a true virtue. So far from it being difficult, children can be virtuous as well as adults, the simple as well as the clever. The means virtue uses is control, not effort. Socrates, the foremost of her darlings, deliberately renounced effort so as to glide along with her easy, natural progress. And so this just makes me think of Jesus saying, my yoke is easy, my burden is light. Come on to me, all of you who are heavy laden. It's like, yeah, there's a way. Like, on the one hand, your kid needs to be out like freezing in the rain.
But they're going to like it.
Yeah. You need to beat your body and make it your slave. On the other hand, you should glide along on the path of virtue. My yoke is easy, my burden is light. I don't know how to synthesize these two paradoxical mentalities around upbringing and education, but I think the paradox is present here in Montaigne. It's present in the Bible.
You do the math. You do the math. Yeah.
Assimilate it into yourself. I'll work on yep. My own self.
Bring the honey. Bring the honey next time.
Yeah. Yeah. There's your marjoram in time. Let me just end it with his final words, because they're of the essay, which I think are really good. And I think a good summary of what he's recommending. And we'll leave on that. Now, to get back to my subject, there is nothing like tempting the boy to want to study and to love it. Otherwise, you simply produce donkeys laden with books. They are flogged into retaining a pannier full of learning. But if it is to do any good, learning must not only lodge with us, we must marry her.